So we've got a few people who are doing, so I'm going to call them sort of like applications, and those are like programs in C and Java that run on your computer, and then there's sort of web applications. So we've got a mix of both, so we'll talk a little bit about both. Okay, so what we thought we'd do is just start running down like the smattering of names of programming languages and libraries that may or may not have been tossed at you, and kind of write the big list on the board of what are those good for, because you're... I'm glad you all are here because you've at least taken the step to say, okay, I want to do this. What is a good programming language and architecture for that? So you're already halfway there. Cool. You want to talk or you want? Okay, so maybe we should start with the non-web applications. So there's the language that you already know, which is C. Got my own Vanna White. This is great. Except all of a sudden he's going to be like, nah, I don't think that's right, which Vanna never did. So what is C good for? So if you have some kind of time critical, like real time kind of thing. So that's a lot of sort of systems-y level programming. See, this is the Vanna White saying no us. Go ahead. The most notable example of the thing that C is not good at and not fast at is string processing.
It's also not good at allocating a lot of memory, especially if you have to allocate and deallocate a lot of memory. Probably, depending on which allocator you use. For example, if you were going to write a C program that would query a binary tree, it would probably
Okay, so that's the things that C aren't good at. But what is C good at? Well, the one good thing about C is that you already know it. You already know it. No, it's true. It's also got, so a lot of the TFs know, so I'll try to say things, because lots of programming languages have good libraries for graphics and things like that. But one of the things that C has is lots of the TFs have experience with those libraries. Right. So there's lots of libraries written for C, and they work very well because they've been very well exercised by people over the years. A lot of you guys are here because you don't want to write programs in C, so we won't spend a lot of time on why C is fun, unless you have anything else. Okay, we can do that. So you're thinking the... That's right. This was the list we talked about at breakfast. So if you ask any of the people, any of the CS50 staff, like libraries in C for doing things, the first three they're going to rattle off are these three very popular libraries. So SDL is a library that does many, many, many things, including sound and sort of 2D graphics. So let's see. Sound, 2D graphics, as we realized earlier last night, you can use it to read from the CD-ROM, because apparently it existed before the CD-ROM was just another file system to read off of. Right, so it's got capability for videos, formats. Go ahead.
The most important thing about SDL is that it's cross-platform. So you can write a program that, say, does 2D graphics and works with sound and video, and you should be able to take that program and compile it on a different kind of system. So it should run on Windows, and it should run on Linux, or it should run on OS X or BOS, or whatever the various things that they ported SDL to. If you don't care about cross-platform, if you just want to write a program that runs on Windows, this might not be a good choice. You might be better off just going straight to the Windows API, because that's what's inside of this library, is the Windows API, and not the entire API is in there. So they've limited what SDL can do to the things that they can port to all the different platforms. So if cross-platform is what you want, then this is good. If you don't care about that, then maybe this isn't what you want. And maybe a workshop on SDL.
And just a quick summarize, since Paul isn't mic'd. Okay, great. Well, then, never mind. Cool. Great. Then you want to do the next one, since you're mic'd? Or not mic'd, but...
OpenGL is primarily a 3D graphics library. OpenGL is already cross-platform. So if you have an implementation of OpenGL on Linux, on the Mac, on Windows, on whatever, then the same programs are supposed to be able to work on all the different platforms. OpenGL also has bindings for lots of languages. So you can program OpenGL in C, or Java, or Ruby, or Python, or whatever you want, pretty much. If you don't need to do three-dimensional graphics, you probably don't want OpenGL, because as soon as you go into OpenGL, you're going to be dealing with three-dimensional graphics, which means knowing a little bit about linear algebra and what means multiplying matrices together and stuff like that. So you don't need to know. If you don't want 3D stuff, then maybe you don't want that. So video games often use OpenGL. So even though I said just if you want 3D graphics, but even if you're doing only 2D graphics, but it's really computationally intensive, and you want that work to be done really fast, say on the GPU. So for instance, if you want to composite a bunch of 2D images together and apply convolutions and all sorts of stuff like that, then you might want to use OpenGL because you can get the graphics card to do all that work for you. And it'll be 100 or 1,000 times faster than what you might write that runs on the CPU. So that's another reason to use OpenGL. If you are only programming in Windows, there's something called DirectX, which is almost exactly the same as OpenGL. But it's a little bit different, and on Windows generally works a little bit better because Microsoft develops this library
for Windows. Right, they're happy to support and test that, whereas they stopped supporting OpenGL a few versions ago.
So, once again, this is cross-platform, or if you're working, say, on a system like Linux or the Mac, this is what you want. If you only care about Windows, then you can get the same thing from there.
Right, I'm going to do this one. So, one of the things that you'll notice if you start using a library like OpenGL is all of a sudden you say, okay, well now I need a button and a text field to take in some user input. And this is where libraries like GTK come in, which are for user interfaces. And you'll learn a very fun word called widget, which is a really silly name for all of the little widgets like buttons and text boxes and radio buttons and slider bars and things like that. And that's what GTK is. So GTK was made for making the program GIMP. You know the GIMP? So when you go to try to look at the GTK documentation, you end up going to the GIMP webpage and finding this very small subsection about GTK. So all this is for is doing the user interfaces and everything, whereas all these are for are doing sort of the graphics part. The good thing is that there are tons of libraries for making an SDL widget in GTK, so that you can have your buttons and everything without having to do that effort.
Is that cross-platform?
So this is cross-platform, and it's going to look...
So it's actually, a lot of people have difficulty getting GTK to work on Microsoft Windows. So it's really been developed by the Linux people.
Right.
Now, it will run on Windows or on the Mac, but you're going to have more difficulty getting it to work on Windows.
That's right.
At least that's the experience that most people accept.
Yeah, and I've actually...
Windows has something called Windows Forms API.
Right. So if you were just going to program on Windows, you'd probably want to use the Forms, because you also get the advantage of using Visual Studio, which has a little GUI builder, and you just drag and drop the buttons where you want it.
Is there a workshop on that?
So, right, there's two more things I wanted to say. So one thing is, if you're doing this sort of user interface tomorrow, I have the event-driven programming workshop where we're going to talk about responding to button clicks and mouse clicks and things like that. The other thing I want to say is GTK is really hard to get to work on Windows, but I found if you download Pidgin or Game for Windows, the GTK pack that they give you, the DLL, works really well. So they managed to get it compiled, and I just always steal that one.
Okay. I think there's a workshop on this, right?
On actual GTK?
Well, maybe there's a workshop, maybe there isn't. But
I guess I
could
look.
There are some TFs that have worked with it before. But I will point out there's an alternative called Qt, which is what the KDE folks use for all their stuff. And it's similar. I mean, it's a similar kind of library. It's just completely different. KDE is a system for Linux, which builds sort of the desktop system.
I think that's the one that actually loads when they log in on NICE.
That's what actually runs on.
Yeah. So if there's not,
but completely different.
Right, and if there's not a seminar on GTK, I have some tutorial like sample programs that I used to post every year, so I'll make sure those get posted.
Do you know about a good image processing library?
What kind of image processing?
Looking for forms or programming, very critical.
You mean like analyzing an image?
Exactly.
To find,
exactly.
I don't know of any. Actually, that kind of stuff is pretty difficult. So I was surprised to teach out a library out there is quite easy. Generally, I mean, the reason why these libraries are so common is because these are sort of solved problems. People have gone off and packaged up.
Right, at the very best, you're going to want to be looking for a library that actually lets you get the individual pixel values of your image.
They do a lot of that kind of work at the MIT Media Lab. So if you go to their website, you might be able to find things about them.
Yeah, or at least see what projects they're working on and what they're using to work on them. Cool.
Okay, so I guess we can continue on the language front for a few more minutes, and then we can talk about the styles of programming architecture. So unlike C, Java has a kind of set of standardized libraries, the Java standard library set. And it's gigantic, and it has lots of things in it. So it has something called Swing, which
I can draw the arrows.
Kind of like GTK and Qt, but for Java.
Right.
It also has something called, I think it's just called Java 3D, which I believe is an OpenGL implementation, but suitably Java-ized. And all of these other things, sound, video, and so forth, I believe there are similar libraries.
Right, they're all in the Java API. So similarly, the already good thing is Java syntax is extremely similar to C syntax, and the Java VM takes away a lot of the pain of programming in C, such as making sure you free your memory and things like that. So it's very similar, so it's easy to get started, and then all of a sudden you find that you're much happier while programming in it. Paul might disagree with that. Trying to think if there's anything else major to say. So another good thing about Java is that it's built to be cross-platform. So you write your program and it'll run on Windows and Linux and Mac.
I guess my advice if you're using Java is download the JDK, whichever one you're going to use, presumably the most recent one, and use the libraries that are already in the JDK. If you find yourself going off and getting some third-party library and trying to install it, you might want to make sure that there isn't already something in the standard library, because that's how Java sort of works. They just absorb all the stuff into the standard library.
I think that's you. Right, if you're doing your program in Java, the first thing you want to make a bookmark to on your web browser is the thing while you're downloading the SDK, there's going to be a link to the API documentation, which is the big bucket of all the libraries that come pre-built, which is great. Yeah.
There are functions like vertex and normal and matrix, multiply. So it really is just like high school linear algebra for three dimensions.
But don't let that...
So you specify a bunch of information, like here are a bunch of points and lines and surfaces and normal vectors and, you know, matrices and transform stuff, and all that information is downloaded onto the graphics card. And a modern graphics card has, I don't know, 100 microprocessors on it, and they crunch all this information and produce a picture.
Right. Along with those, there's also going to be the place the camera and set the depth of your world and everything, those kind of functions. Turn the lights on, things like that.
So I guess we can talk for a few minutes about programming architecture. But if you use SDL or GTK or Qt, you're going to be giving up the entry point of your program to the library. So you no longer will be writing main. You'll write a main function, but it won't do anything. It'll just sort of hand off control to the library. And the libraries themselves actually run your program for you. And you just sort of write little functions that off to the side which tell it what to do in various situations.
Right, and that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow, which is this idea of handing off control of your program, but writing the, here's what happens when the mouse button gets clicked, here's what happens when you press this button, here's what happens when they hit enter on the keyboard. Those kind of things. So that's the architecture we're going to... I'm plugging my seminar tomorrow.
So you should expect to see a main if you're using a library.
That's right. So certainly, yeah, these three, you're not going to see the main. You're just going to write a whole bunch of stuff and then compile it, and they've got main. SDL, it's debate. There's two ways. We'll talk about it tomorrow.
If there is a main function,
yeah, or like wait for something to happen, do the thing that's supposed to happen when that thing happens. Cool.
Okay, so there's, I guess we can write up here. Okay.
Right.
Which is very typical of 2D.
Yeah, I think everything that we've been talking about so far is going to be one of these event-driven programs.
And alternative to this, one alternative to this, is multi-threaded programming, which you might want to not attempt to do this.
Oh, I'll walk.
You really want a challenge. So an alternative to waiting for events and responding to them, in fact, we have lots of different threads of execution in the program. We've got one thread over here waiting to see whether or not someone has moved the mouse. You've got another thread over here maybe going to the screen. And all those things are coordinated with one another.
Right. So if I can say it a slightly different way. So the programs that you guys have been writing, when you're writing C code, you say things like get line and stuff like that, and then the program waits for the user to enter input and then continues, and you sort of control the flow of the program. And if you like that kind of programming much more than, you know, if the seminar tomorrow makes your head hurt, then there's an approach which is to still have everything waiting for things to happen, but have it have multiple threads all waiting for things to happen. So here a lot of the TFSA, something like a console style program, and that's that waiting for the user to enter input.
So the other two styles of programming I think you're going to encounter is for the web-based people. You're essentially doing client-server programming, where you're either writing a client or a server, sometimes both. And the server typically waits for a client to make some kind of request and then delivers a response. And the client, on the other hand, makes requests and gets responses back. So that, in a nutshell, is HTTP. So the web-based projects are all in this style. The other thing the web-based people are going to be doing is declarative programming. And what this means is that you don't specify how your program does what it does, you just specify what should be the result. And the example of this that you've seen so far is SQL. So when you write an SQL statement, you're not saying how the SQL the data is being collected and returned. You're just saying what data you want to be returned to you.
Right, give me all the things with user ID 4.
So the web projects are going to have to program in both of these styles and make choices about what things go in the database and when do I use declarative techniques and when do I write a server and when do I write a client.
Cool.
You want to say?
I think I want to move on to, while we're already on the client-server and declarative, it might be good to talk about client-side scripting and server-side as language choices for the web people. Okay. Good, we have a good eraser. Anybody need any of this? Okay. It's on video if you do. I should have left the "you already know it" and made this the PHP column. Okay. So the other side of the world, the client-server web programmers, there's been already a little bit of two big languages being tossed around, which are PHP and JavaScript. And there are still other choices. There are more than that. But we'll start with these because they represent sort of two camps for that. I'm going to use white chalk because the purple doesn't erase well. Okay. PHP. You already kind of know it. So this is server-side scripting. So what does that mean? So what happened in the problem set that you guys just turned in, which I assume because you're all here, you wrote some PHP code. When you went to quote.php on your web browser, what happens? Stuff happened, and then CS50 Finance showed up on my screen. So you wrote some code. You wrote some HTML, and embedded in that HTML was some things that looked like this guy right here. On the web server, on the fast web server, these snippets of PHP get executed on the server and translated into whatever they printed out in HTML. And that is what got sent from the server to the client. And that's why that's called server-side, because everything happens on the web server. Banna, no comments so far? Okay. So some good things about server-side scripting are that the user, there's no way when they say view source on their web browser to see any of the PHP code that you're writing. And there was all that fixed web files and stuff, which set your permissions properly so that there was no way for people to read those PHP files. Only you could. So that's a good thing about server-side scripting.
So on the client side, you really only have one choice, which is JavaScript, also called ECMAScript. And this is code that when you download a web page, you might have stuff that looks like this, but completely different. Maybe it says script, and then you have some code in here. And the stuff around it is all HTML. So you can see it's kind of the same idea. Except the language in here is different, and that language runs on the client. So unlike the PHP, which is running on the web server, the JavaScript is running on your computer inside of your web browser. So, for instance, if you wanted to query a database that was on your server, which one of these would you use?
Sorry, Harry broke it.
Right. You would use that one because the code running here doesn't necessarily have any access information that's on the server. Similarly, if you want to, say, make a pop-up window, then you wouldn't write that in PHP on the server because it's not running on the client. You want to actually do something on the client.
Right. Or if you actually want something that's even more dynamic. So we said a lot, we pushed the word dynamic when we were talking about PHP, is dynamic web content, because it's being generated right there on the server. Now if you want the even more dynamic things that are actually continually executing on the client, like something animating or, I don't know, something like that, there's no way to do that on the server side because it only asks the server once.
But you all know that there are things like Google Mail client, which seems to be getting information off the server all the time, even though you're looking at the same web page. And what's going on there is that the JavaScript that's running on your client is essentially making a request for something on the server without, in the background. That information is coming back. And the JavaScript that's running is then processing all the information that it got back and building HTML dynamically. And that whole sort of asynchronous background request response, building things dynamically on the client, blah, 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 is referred to as AJAX. And AJAX isn't really a thing. It's an idea about how to program client-server stuff when you've got these two different kinds of languages. Simple request response client server stuff.
Right. And if you have been wondering how the Apple desktop widgets work, because that's just all one page, that's really just a web page, it uses JavaScript to do that sort of dynamic looking content. Okay. So these are the two. I should. Okay. So I want to make the quick little cute joke, though, that if you're doing server-side scripting, you're not limited to PHP by any means. I mean, so that first line you had in your PHP file that said what interpreter to use to read that those comments, I mean, you could put any kind of interpreter, any program that interprets code at the top there.
Actually, in enterprise systems, it's much more common to use Java there and JavaScript here. And I've even seen systems where people are using JavaScript. Threading is a little bit of an odd choice, but there's no problem with that. And if you really want things that are fast, like for instance, if you go to work at Google, working on their main search application, you're going to be writing C code. Because they really need the kind of speed that you can get.
Right. And because everything, the server is now the bottleneck for them, because everybody's executing server-side code. Cool. This is sort of an aside column, because I don't want to say you do one of these or this one. You're going to do these and this. So this is for managing data.
What do you mean by I'm sorry? You said you can put any definition, right? Like you say you can use C.
Well, if you were using C, you would probably compile the C program. There are interpreters.
Yeah, because I said you'd put any interpreter at the top. But.
Right. So I actually work at a large internet company called Pocket. PHP is running inside of the web server itself. So you also have the web server. And what we did there is we just rewrote the web server so that it had built into it the kind of dynamic things we needed. Because we really wanted So there was no interpreter in sense. It was a giant C program, which was a web server, and it had all this other stuff.
I wanted to amend my managing data. It's very vague. So you guys have used a little bit of SQL using the MySQL. So SQL databases are for storing data, obviously. It's the data that you care about while your users are using your page that needs to be actually kept persistent, unlike the get and the post kind of things that you were doing that can frolic off if they close the window. These are the things that need to stay. Or possibly, depending on the choices you make, you may be storing things in the database that are going to be around for a while, but maybe deleted at the end of some session. So I'm going to give my little speech and then see what Paul has to add. But so you may have found when you were programming C programs and things like that, that the very first thing you do is understand the kind of data that you're using. When you went to write Huffman, the first thing you looked at was, what's a Huffman tree? And then thought about the operations you're going to be doing on that tree. Somehow we lose this thought of thinking about the data first when we start doing web programming, even though it's more important. So if there was something I was going to suggest to you if you're doing a web app, is think about what kind of data you need and lay out those SQL tables in a good way. And if you don't know how to do it in a good way, ask someone who does, like Paul, to help you. Because once you have the tables laid out, everything becomes a lot easier. That was my soapbox. Thanks.
Right. Yeah, so you should definitely design your database before you write a single line of code. And it's really just a bunch of tables, as we talked about in the lecture, I guess. And so you should definitely design all those first. You should also keep in mind that you're not limited to using SQL just if you have a web project. And there are also a couple of different kinds of ways of getting this database functionality. So the one that we've talked to you about in class is called MySQL. And MySQL is really just a SQL front end to a collection of binary trees. And those binary trees are actually manipulated with another system, which is called Berkeley DB, which is produced by Margot Seltzer, who works over in NB. So you can talk to her about the SQL. And then there's another system called SQLite, which is also just a collection of binary trees on disk with a SQL-like language that you can use to access that information. And it's really simple to use. It's just a C library. And these systems don't provide a lot of concurrency. If you want to have 1,000 people submitting a query at the same time, it's really going to slow down with these systems because they lock the whole database at once, and so only one person at a time. If you really need high concurrency, then you need a real database, a real SQL database server, such as Oracle or DB2, or there's a free one called Postgres, which you can download and use. And the difference here is that there's actually a program running off the side that you send your queries to, and then it sends back the results in a client-server way. And that server program can handle thousands of people all sending queries at the same time. But depending on what you need, you can choose to make them easier all the time from the program.
Right. So I want to make the quick pitch real quick. If you are working on a web app, so if you're working on a Facebook app, I think Facebook actually allows you to use their, what do they call it?
FQL,
which is like SQL queries, but for their database. And I think they actually give you a little bit of ability to write some data through their stuff. I'll have to double check that. But you may not even have to make this choice. You might just be able to use the FQL. I can't say it without grinning. Okay, so that was our big overview, I think, unless you have anything else you want to drop in.
So I guess we'd be happy to answer any questions about, particularly for your project, what libraries are available or what, you know, kinds of, how you should architect your program, whether you should be trying to write an event-driven program or a client server program.
Or I hate C and Java. What other languages? I want something completely different. We'll be happy to answer that question. So it's in the same family as C and Java. I would definitely categorize it as in the exact same family as Java. With the sort of added, it used to be C, so you still can manage the memory if you want to. I'm not a big fan of C++, but if you want that really rich, oh my goodness, systems programming overwhelming feeling, that's a good reason to do C++ code. I have such a negative attitude towards
C++. C++ is an attempt to make C into an object-oriented language. And C++ is actually really good if you have a huge amount of code with lots of people working on it, and you want to try to manage all those people. It's really great in providing encapsulation and giving you a way of working on lots of different things at the same time.
Right, and that's the OO but programming.
I think a lot of people would say that C++ not really an object-oriented language. It's just an imperative language, C, with some object-oriented-like stuff put on top of it. But because C++ is so widespread, it's sort of become what object-oriented programming means among people. So what it basically is, you know, in C you have structs. And I think we didn't talk about function pointers in the class, but you can actually get a pointer to a function, and you can call the function. If you wanted to, you'd have a struct that had a bunch of function pointers in it. And you could give that struct to me, and I can take an element out of that struct, and I can follow the pointer to find a function to run. And if you wanted to, you could use these structs to build up sort of objects that have data and functions, and you could pass them around, and you could have structs that have other structs inside them. And really, that's how C++ works. It's just they give you a lot of nice syntax. They give you a way of declaring a class, a way of instantiating objects, which build these kind of structs and function pointers. So in a sense, that's what C++ is doing. It's taking these object-oriented things and making them work in a context of C. Now, to be fair, modern C++ has a whole bunch of other stuff there. Templates and lots of other things.
Right. So the standard template library is the sort of, and I hate saying this, it's the equivalent to the sort of Java standard library. It's the C++ standard library. Just a good thing if you are planning on using C++. A lot of the libraries that we were writing up for C, you can use any of those, and they have C++, more object-oriented feeling kind of API to it also.
Yeah, that's the great thing about C++. It's completely compatible. If you have anything that's written in C, you can use C++.
Right.
Actually, vice versa.
Just most people who program C++ will call it a little bit more painful than say.
Yeah, there are a lot of gotchas in C++ because they introduced mechanisms, you know, like they introduced operator overloading. We didn't talk about overloading. And it doesn't quite work the way it does in other languages. So if you're used to operator overloading in other languages, you're going to be surprised sometimes with exactly what goes on.
What he means by operator overloading is like saying plus means call this function instead of nothing. Like if you could do plus of two structs or something like that. Well, plus of two objects.
So anyway, yeah. But C++ is great because there's so many little nooks and crannies and special cases that if you really master C++, you're like this genie, you know, that has all the secret knowledge around. No one understands.
Hey, that was the really cool thing to be in, like, 1997 or whatever. It really was, like, yeah. Ooh. What's cool now? What are the genes? So we're both PhD students, and our area is programming languages, which means that we're functional programmers. Most people who say they're PL like functional programming. So we like languages like Haskell and Lisp and ML and things like that. So that's not a real answer. That's not what's cool with everybody. That's what I'm
the scripting languages are really popular. Ruby, I think, is a really nice language. I would say Ruby is an object-oriented language in sort of true sense. So if you want to learn object-oriented programming, I would say go to that Ruby. Or the language that's based on what's called Smalltalk. It's kind of old now, so maybe it's not as fun as Ruby.
Right. I think the cool thing, just I have to answer this question because it's a fun question. I think the cool people now are like web scripters and Python programmers. Is that what's really cool now? But
yeah.
Don't be cool. Do Ruby instead of Python. And
what's that longevity? It sounds like all these programming languages are what you're saying. So what actually
That's a good question.
So the thing to understand about languages, I think, is that you need to realize what languages are good for and be an educated consumer of languages. Because it's always going to be the case that there are lots and lots of languages. The one thing that hasn't changed is the fact that there are really only three primary programming paradigms out there. And languages kind of fit into those paradigms in different ways. And those paradigms are essentially imperative programming, which is C is sort of the example of what that is. The basic mechanism of programming is you have a bunch of memory, and you change that memory as you go along, and at some point you stop, and somewhere in that memory is the answer to the computation you want to
do. Right. You don't write what you want to do, you write, or what you want to get, you write the side effects that make that happen.
So that's essentially imperative programming. That's the style of programming. And there are lots of languages that have that style, and they have slightly different systems. And once you've programmed a little bit and learned a couple of languages, you can pick up syntax really easily once you know that, oh, this is an imperative style of programming, so I'm going to remember the imperative style. The other styles that are out there, like another large one is functional programming. So if you take 51, you'll learn Scheme, which is a functional language, and there are lots of others like Standard ML, as you're saying, Pascal. And that's a completely different style of programming. If you understand how to program in a functional style, then you come across a functional language and say, oh, this is a functional language, syntax is a little bit different. And then you also have declarative languages like SQL, which are their own kind of thing. Prolog also goes into that category, just logic programming language. And then I guess object-oriented, like in the true sense of Smalltalk, is another style of programming, which is essentially imperative.
Yeah.
It has its own flavor. The real thing is, you know, learn one language in each of the different buckets. Or learn two languages in each of the different buckets. And then you'll be able to pick up any language.
Right. And if you want to start with the biggest bucket, you start with the imperative bucket and you pick up two of those. And then that's the largest family.
So we've been focusing on imperatives, so PHP, Perl, C, these are all imperative languages. So you've really only been exposed to one paradigm. Well, with the exception of SQL, which is completely different.
Right, but you start out 51 with functional, which is really nice.
Functional programming. Logic programming, I guess the only place you would see that is in 152.
But it's cool. Okay. So more questions about, and they can totally be really specific to your project, or feel free to leave too.
C can be slow depending on how it's used. I mean, if you're allocating and deallocating a lot of memory, when you're just using malloc, C is not going to do well.
So what is the best language for allocating and deallocating?
Usually languages that have a garbage collector are better for that because the way they allocate memory is usually really, really fast. And they don't deallocate any memory unless they absolutely have to.
Right, so your garbage collector languages, the big popular ones are Java and Java. Right.
Not really. No.
Yeah, it's got some better constructs for hiding the mallocs and the frees from you, but there's still mallocs and frees.
If you're manipulating matrices, it might be worth looking at specialized languages like MATLAB.
Right, and also if you're doing a lot of scientific computing, MATLAB. Someone else brought up, is it R?
R is a statistical
don't know that much about R, so I'm hesitant to say, but I'm guessing that it's just much more declarative in nature than anything else, just from what little I've seen about it.
Yeah, I looked it up a little bit when it became hot on the bulletin board. Yeah. And it's, right, it's writing equations.
Something like, give me the mean of this data set. And give me the mean data set.
It did, yeah. A few people have been talking about using different math libraries. So MATLAB's already on NICE, and there are certainly ways to integrate MATLAB with your whatever programming language you're using. So,
believe it or not, you're going to be doing a lot of matrix stuff, heavy math. Fortress is probably the best language, although it's still in development.
So take it or leave it?
Take it or leave it.
So you're not going to launch the MATLAB IDE, the big MATLAB GUI. You're going to use some sort of library. Right. Right. And then make those calls from your program. Right. The big thing that takes forever to load up is that big integrated developer environment and the little window that'll show you your pretty matrices and things like that.
Right. You should draw the distinction between MATLAB the program.
Right, that's just the bottom right corner.
You know, Emacs, the text editor, which has built into it scheme programming language, or to list programming language. And you can write an Emacs program and run it without running Emacs. That occurs a lot.
How do you do that? How do you, like, browse?
So I'm not that familiar with MATLAB. I've done that a while. A lot of these systems, they have special programs you can run. You can give the source of your file and it will just run it. Or they may even have special compilers. Just like you call the GCC and you give it the file and it produces the program, there might be something like MATLAB C. I don't know.
Right, and in a lot of cases, they have little library bindings. Like when you guys are calling SQL from PHP, you use PHP MySQL. Which gives you a function for saying, please go run this, and it takes it and sends it to the interpreter and everything. Right.
Right. But every programming language that exists essentially has, you know, something that takes in the syntax and produces some lower form of the language and then either evaluates it or produces a binary. So if there's a language, somewhere there's that thing that does that.
Right. And you can always say, please go run that thing for me and then take the results back into your code at the very worst. But a lot of these combinations are very popular, especially I'm sure there's lots of bindings for MATLAB because MATLAB's huge. As huge as math libraries get.
And if you want to use C, I think there's a very old but still very good library called LinTap, which does a lot of major stuff really fast.
Mm-hmm.
Can't find a LinTap library. Searching around in Google for LinTap will certainly lead you to
all the benchmarks that other programming languages use. This is a popular, every programming language, their compiler writers use LinPack bindings to test their compiler to make sure it's fast. Okay.
The other thing you can try, which comes more under the category of research, maybe, you can run matrix computations on your graphics.
If anyone gets really excited about that idea, Norm, who's in Cambridge working at AMD, well, ATI, but now that's AMD, that's exactly the research that he's doing.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's really exciting because the GPU has hundreds of parallel processors on
So are you talking like
I'm using this like image processing program called ReadyTrack. Plus, I can do some function on the
Yeah, so this is the problem of being a working programmer, I guess. Is that, often you're going to go out and you're going to try to choose some set of libraries or a language or a system like a database that you want to use to build your program. And how you make that choice is a difficult in a lot of cases. In your case, you want to extend the library to do something else. So I would first try to write what it is you want to write using the API that the library gives you. And only as a last resort, sort of go in and modify the actual library itself.
So you're modifying existing program, right? Not a library.
Modifying existing program.
So I would still definitely write the piece that you want to add sort of on the side, outside the program for a little bit. Is that possible? As much as you can do without having to insert yourself in the guts of that program, do that for as long as possible. Right, depending what they use. We can look at it. We should look at it. I'm going to add a third, which is parsing.
Right, so if you have a text file with a bunch of data in it, then you can parse that text file and write functions, do queries. And if you wanted to, you can even write something that would take a SQL statement and then do that stuff on the text file and get back the result. Actually, Kevin Redwine, one of our colleagues, did just that. You're the SQL front end for text file. But it's going to be slower than a SQL database. And the other thing is that a lot of these databases have most of the code in there, or a lot of the code in there, has to do with making sure that all the data is consistent all the time. So if you're going to insert a row into a database and then the machine crashes, is the data still going to be okay? And these systems like SQLite and BerkeleyDB go to a lot of effort to try to make sure that the data files themselves are always going to be stable. Plus, you get to use something like SQL, which is a nice declarative way. But if you think, I don't want to mess around with all these databases and SQL and blah, 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 and I just want a text file and I do parsing, then do that.
All right, and it depends on, I would ask yourself sort of two questions, which is actually maybe more. How complicated is the data that you're storing in the text file? Like, if it's literally just a list of, words separated by new lines, then you're sort of okay. If it's a little bit more complicated, as soon as you're like, okay, so is there, it's a word separated by spaces and then a number and things like that. What if there are numbers in my words? And those kind of questions become a pain in the neck. And then the other question is, are you going to be changing what's in that file? Like, are you going to be adding, is there extensions to add more data that you're going to be keeping track of? Then all of a sudden, it's probably worth investing the time to set up something like SQLite. We looked at it because we had someone with the same question, and it's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, it's really, really easy to use. You just say, open database, and give it a file name, and give it SQL queries, and it uses that.
Right.
So SQLite is, believe it or not, much easier to use than MySQL, which is sort of surprising because MySQL is already SQL.
Right. And all it really is storing the data on files. So it's sort of the same thing, but giving you all the power of not having to parse that file, which is such a pain, especially if you're going to do it in C, then you're in a world of hurt.
Right. C is not the language. It's probably already wherever you are. I know OS X has it already installed by default. I'm pretty sure the fast machines would have it.
And if we can take a quick look. If it's not, we'll just ask the UA people to put it on there. This is the time of year where we start harassing the FAST staff to give us a lot of stuff installed, so it's fun. We're happy to do it. Okay, everybody's starting to seem go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. That's lame. So HCS, especially if you just drop them an email, I think they'll. Do they? Okay. Right. So the only reason that you would need to use something that's not your NICE account is something like that, like they don't let you use cron jobs. But other than that, we can get stuff installed and things like that. So certainly don't go buy any domain name or anything like that to host your own web server. Cool. Yeah, you guys are, feel free, don't feel bad about leaving. Get started.
Right, and how do I, I'm not sure how, is there a tutorial for what the functions in the library do and how to be able to do this?
So, the good thing is all what everything in the library does is really highly well documented in there.
I think you're going to want Java 3D and Swing.
Right, so if you look up, like, there are tons of tutorials on the web, and I can actually, if you, I have your email with your proposal, so I can send you back a few good places to start, because I used to teach Java classes, so I've got tons of friends who are like, here's my Pac-Man in Java, and here's my other thing, so we can start there. But if certainly if you, Java's one of those languages, if you Google Java thing you want to do, it, you'll find it. So for what you want to do with the 3D programming, I would go with Java, because the Java 3D is much older, which is more vetted than, I have no idea what C# has for 3D graphics.